regard to these designs, the modular design, the $80,000 to $100,000 cost for the cell. Is there, you know, did the department have design options that would have met National Corrections Standards and any court decrees, but elect to go beyond those types of acceptable judicial and correctional standards?
No, I have been concerned about that all along, and my instructions to the contractors were that I wanted a Spartan, but very durable kind of institution. I did not want the fancy goodies that architects sometimes put into these buildings. They will be Spartan. I think I shared some of the drawings before. There's not anything fancy about them. As I said a little earlier, the costs really are related to the hardware that goes into them. And even that, we attempted to restrict to the lowest possible level.
But now the hardware in the design that is so expensive would be most expensive, I assume, in the maximum security setting rather than the medium.
Well, yes, relatively speaking, but that's the advantage of the prototypical housing unit because, for example, you can put a wooden, solid core wooden door on the cell for a minimum or even a medium security inmate. But maximum security inmate, that door may have to be steel. It may also have to slide or be electronically operated. So that's where the cost comes in.
But with the $2 million worth of design, or let's take the $950,000 worth of design, if I were looking at them on this table, pertain to a maximum security facility?
Yes, what we're talking about, Ed Stewart, is a long-term high security facility.
In terms of the utility of those designs, prototypically, they would be most valuable if the state were going out to have other maximum security facilities there, rather than leading security facilities.
I'm not sure I understand, but if you could use the same design and at lower cost, put in less costly hardware, and it would drop the cost considerably. But we don't need
in a medium security space, is the control measured from cell block to cell block or external to the world? Are you concerned about the movement of prisoners within that space, or are you concerned about keeping them from escape to the outside world?
Well, in fact, there are many levels of security, but in a high security institution, you want to control a prisoner in a cell, you want to control it in a day room space adjacent to that cell, you want to restrict it to the housing unit, then you want to restrict it to the entire compound, which is double security fences. So you want to make sure that the offender doesn't get out of the institution, certainly. That's your perimeter security. There just is no, you know, I would be happy to. I've been in and out of prisons, I guess, most of my life, and I've been in all kinds of them in this nation and other nations. High security institutions are a very sophisticated, complex kind of building. And I don't know any way to lower those costs except through design. Once the facility is built and the operational costs are important, that's the other consideration. We've designed this to be as staff efficient as we think is possible.
Okay. Senator Compton.
Yeah, I just have one more question on the location and site of the facilities. I realize that that's a difficult area. But one of the things that I think caused you some initial problems was saying yes to an area and then changing your mind. There were newspaper articles that went out through last year that the prison's going to be here, the prison's going to be there. In one case, I think it was this day, the article stated something in effect that the prison's going to be at Goose Bay, and we're going to have hearings to determine that. And the Aegis message went out that had been the Aegis election before the hearings, and then it was changed. And I realize it's difficult to cite facilities in my community, but good example of their feelings back and forth on the facility there. But I think, I don't know if you have any response to that, what happened through that process.
Sure.
I think you said, you know, the Chamber of Commerce side and the public side, but it seems like we're naive if we really think that that's all there is to it. I think there's an awful lot of politics in the siting of prison, whether you like it or we like it.
Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely true. As I responded to Senator Moss earlier, that is in fact what happened in Goose Bay. We met with the Chambers of Commerce, the business leaders, and so on. We had one public hearing open to everybody. So we had about three meetings in the Wasilla area before we announced that was the most likely site we probably proceed there to build our maximum security facility. Then some of the folks who lived along the Connecticut Road area got together and they wanted to voice their opposition. So they invited me to a meeting at the Settlers Day Lodge, and there clearly they were opposed. That's when we determined that it would not be acceptable to build that. So, yes, I will concede that the public hearing process is extremely difficult. And I probably learned a great deal in that process, but I wouldn't reverse it. I still believe that the public hearing process is absolutely acceptable.
I think the criticism, and I have been in similar situations. I conducted public hearings around the state. I think that the criticism is not that the public was invited to participate, or I think you're to be commended for doing that. I think the criticism lies in ad hoc or seriatim decisions or tentative decisions announced that the prison will be at Goose Bay or Palmer Sutton, Fire Island, and then seeing the department having to withdraw from those decisions and go somewhere else to like somewhere else. I think, again, the advantage of Monday morning quarterbacking that conceivably it would be better to have public hearings wherever prisons are under consideration, Anderson, Seward, Goose Bay, Fire Island, Anchorage, and keep your counsel until you're prepared to digest all the information, then come out with a tentative decision, one tentative decision to respond to. That, I think, would be probably better for everybody. That is my reflection on it.
In hindsight, I think it came across to the public that you were telling everybody what they wanted to hear at the time, and then it changed as their opinion changed. And that's, hindsight is always 20/20, and foresight is seldom better than 2600.
Well, Anderson had a referendum for it, and they voted for it. Oh, you didn't ever hear that?
So did Seward, so did Palmer, so did
Dave. Oh, but Anderson was way up there in front. You didn't even look at nobody north of the last grade.
Just a real quick question, you keep mentioning about the hindsight, and now that all that's passed, and Best Site has been selected by the administration, the question I have is, at what point can we see the furnishings, and where can we see some kind of a list as to what's going to win this individual cell, the facility cell?
That should follow, I would guess, by next summer, we should have some detail.
Senator Halpert has a question for you, and I think we're not near the end of this yet. We have another 30 or 45 minutes to proceed. I'll speak out of order here, Commissioner, to say that while I've been critical in some respects, I find that you come from a position with certainly the credentials and the intellectual background, the energy, the idealism that the position demands. I don't want to lose sight of those qualities and qualifications that we proceed to, but maybe nitpicking in your mind to go over some of these areas where we have our concern. Senator Hutchins.
Yeah, just before I ask the question, I think that I would disagree with that statement. My concerns are concerns of management, not concerns of ideology or desire to provide leadership. I think that somebody said something to the fact that leaders know that the price of nothing is the price of everything, and managers know that the price of everything is the value of nothing. It's hard to find the way to get through that.
But instead of that Republican, they have the price of everything.
The question I had was on the Point Warsaw facility. That's one that people have asked me questions about, not only about what's there, and was that something that was dropped because of all the pressures and points, or is there anything there that would be suitable for a prisoner? What's there?
Well, from a physical perspective, Point Warsaw does provide a buildable site. It was our assessment that politically that would be unacceptable to assess its damage. So we dropped it very early.
But I heard there was a lot of buildings there that converted would be fairly easy.
I think you're referring to Point Campbell. Point Campbell, it's another form of military. Yes, that kind of things, getting the thing delivered, putting it back. That we achieved, by the way, at no expense. The only expense there is the building materials.
The next topic would be the discussion of the Cleary case, and maybe we should move on from that. I do have in our file some of the opinions and memoranda in that case, if you want to review it, unless you have, Commissioner, something in the way of a handout for us?
Yes, if I might.
Yes. Prisoners from sexual assault while they are in
occurred for centuries, they will probably occur for great long fields back in the future. We do our best to prevent them, but there isn't any way that we can guarantee that it won't happen.
Are there particular institutions in your system which are more apt to be sites for that type of abuse?
I don't really think so, because if it, well, as hard as it may sound, I think these are random occurrences. They occur infrequently, rarely, and fortunately that's the case. There isn't any pattern that I'm aware of in any one institution.
For example, someone told me that at the, I guess, 3rd Avenue Jail program.
No, it's okay.
But at the 3rd Avenue Jail, that there was an inmate who told me before your regime that he had been raped there, and that he was in a cell which was not observable during most, or cell block. It was not physically observable by guards on shift. Does that ring any bells with you as plausible?
Oh, yes. I do say it's plausible. It all goes back to poor design again. The new designs that we have will make it less likely by far that that can happen. But we have several facilities where it gets back to the technicalities of design. It's the old telephone pole, but the 3rd Avenue is different, but the old telephone pole style of design where you have, what the guards really watch are long corridors. They don't watch cells. And as long as you have that kind of an environment, there is the hazard of assaults of all kinds.
I think this material in theory parses up, which I appreciate, will suffice for our new members have specific questions.
Yeah, one of the things that's irritated people in the public is the consideration that under the Clary settlement, we may be mandated to provide things to inmates that other people can't afford. Now, that could be in the form of better education than people can afford. It can be the form of dental care or something else. Does the Clary settlement medical provisions, for example, require dental work to the extent of the kind of thing that you or I have to save up the money and see if you're really going to get that tooth crowned or when you're going to do it and so on and so forth? Or just strictly they can go in there and if they're in for 2 years, they come out with everything done that they can think of and need to get done?
No, it doesn't. It speaks only to necessary medical attention, and in no case would it be care not available to the ordinary citizen.
So it's not restorative or bridge and crown work and this kind of stuff is very expensive.
That's right. It's not. It's only for the inmates. Dental work related only to his health and well-being.
One area affecting prisoners that I did want to inquire about was the issue of therapy, psychotherapy in the broad sense, counseling. I noticed that the court ordered an area of counseling, drug and alcohol treatment apparently does not relate to an area approximating an existing standard agency operating procedure. And by your legend, it is also not subject to legislative funding. I'm looking at item 9 on your list. What did the court order with respect to counseling, drug, and alcohol treatment? What are you undertaking to comply with that order? And what, if anything, must the legislature do to make it possible for you to comply with it?
Well, first of all of these items have not been settled in trial. I mean, some of them are still pending.
Is that one of the areas that he has under advisement?
Yeah, in general, it's the area of rehabilitation. And I feel fairly comfortable that we've presented a very substantial case to the court. As a matter of fact, maybe like we've got a program summary here at each of our institutions and what they provide in terms of rehabilitation, all kinds of programs, counseling, alcohol, sexual offender work. So I feel very comfortable that what we provided in testimony to the court should go a long way in convincing the court that our programs are good, they're of adequate quantity and quality. And in fact, we had expert testimony from corrections officials from elsewhere around the nation who came in and testified to that same area.
Since we're not on camera here, let me give you one case, and may not mean anything to you, but in my private law practice, I have been approached by a church to assist Mr. Polly, who was represented by the public defender agency that may not be. And he was convicted of some counts of sexual abuse of members of his family. And I think he received an 8-year sentence. Some question arose as to where he would be incarcerated, and I'll talk to you about that part in a minute. But as I understand it, an individual in that situation who will spend 8 years incarcerated and is there for a sex offense and needs therapy will receive that therapy prior to release.
Yes.
I may be alone in this, in the Senate, in the House, I don't know, but I'm bothered by the fact that somebody with a known illness or mental problem of that severity could languish for 4, 5, or 6 years before in custody, after conviction, before there would be an attempt at therapy, because I would consider first that that is almost, not constitutionally speaking, but morally speaking, an additional form of cruel punishment to treat him, that, to not treat him. And it, probably his situation may be exacerbated before treatment can be given if he languishes for that period of time without any attention of a psychological sort. Could you comment on that?
Well, sure. First of all, the problem is that we've got a mandatory sentence. 8 years. Someone or a group of people, in their wisdom, decided that 8 years was necessary for persons convicted of that kind of offense. Secondly, then, if we're going to treat that person for a psychological or social problem, we try to assemble those resources and provide the treatment. But in fact, we have 307 sexual offenders in our system now, today.
Out of 1,000.
Out of 17. So,
I'm sorry,
something like that. But there are 300, over 300 now sexual offenders where 2 years ago, perhaps it's three, we'd have trouble finding 50 who were in for sexual assault or sexual offense crimes. The law has increased the number of people who are in prison on sexual assaults. I'm not sure that people are wrong in wanting these people to be taken off the streets. That may be correct. But as to the length of time, who can say in 8 years is appropriate or inappropriate?
I think it's incorrect that our law tries to deal with a problem that should be dealt with at the retail level, at the wholesale level, in the sense that an individual's profile who assaults a 2-year-old or a 15-year-old or a stranger or a member of the household is treated for sentencing purposes in all in the same manner. I find that, and that's an issue that someone is challenging in court now, I think Mr. Langstaff is challenging.
Yes, we do have, I don't spout these numbers, but I believe it's something like 60 to 80 people who are actually in therapy at any one time. And the therapy could be long-lasting, that is, it could last for a year or longer. But clearly, we just have a limited amount of time and space and resources to meet those people. We will rotate the people through, but Joe Notes, who comes in tomorrow, may get his therapy immediately and then serve the remaining 7 years. The other guy may serve 7 years and then get his therapy.
I have a feeling the pendulum is about to swing back in the other direction. I know Judge Moody's comments in the paper were critical of his own sentence in these cases. The cost factor is getting in the public. If I'm here next year, I would want to do something about that.
Just so I can try to clarify that. So you're opposed to the minimum mandatory sentence, right?
Well, that's a little too general. I think that mandatory sentences do cause problems, and unless there's some evidence of some sort that the length of time that's in the mandatory sentence is meaningful somehow, then it doesn't make sense.
Now, the Constitution mentions protection of the public and rehabilitation.
Yes.
But we often hear different comments from the public and what they're looking for from the criminal justice system. And I guess the feeling, if you tie it to any one word that we seem to get from the public, is one of retribution. And I wonder, do you think there's any place in the correctional system or in the criminal justice system for retribution, either under the Constitution or in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely. There are some among our offender population who should be confined for a very long time, and because we don't have any known mechanisms to deal with people go to prison to be punished. Now, they also hope that something will happen to them while they're there that will change their behavior, and they'll come out as law-abiding citizens. Well, that presents a bit of a dilemma for us. So we try to do both and probably have some problems accomplishing that.
Why is that? I mean, some people would say that spare the rod and spoil the child for us. And if you punish them, they will come. They are more likely to come out.
Well, I've taken a different approach. I'm kind of jumping ahead here of what I tended to say. But I think that, that if we have a combination of putting prisoners to work, able-bodied people to work, there would only be a minority who would refuse to work or be such a risk that we could permit them to. I think we should put them to work 8 to 5 Monday to Friday, and I think that we ought to have therapeutic programs, recreational programs, television, and so on, available to them in the evening and on weekends, the same as it would be for you and I. I think they should earn money while they're serving time, and from those earnings, they should repay the victim, they should make partial contributions to support their family, they should set aside gate money for their control release. I think the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is absolutely correct when he says that we can evolve into factories of fences. And I believe that he's on the right track. It's not new, however, in spite of the fact that he is Chief Justice. Those ideas and concepts have been around for several centuries. But in American penology, we've gotten away from that. We went through reformatories and other kinds of movements. We went through a rehabilitation movement. And then, the academics, several people came along and criticized that nothing works. I don't believe that either. I think things do work. In my experience working with inmates years ago, when I was on the line of corrections, I found that confrontational therapies do work. You force an inmate to start talking about why he's in prison, and you confront him about his behavior, not only for what got him into prison, but for what he does from that day forward. You make him understand he's responsible for the decisions and choices that he makes. And he has to accept that responsibility, and it works. When it was formerly known as Eagle River, we had an excellent operation there. It worked very well. Unfortunately, a couple of incidents happened that got public attention, and as usual in the correctional business, a couple of rare and unusual circumstances can bring the downfall of everything good that you've got going.
What do you do when you've got somebody that's got a life sentence? I don't know if he's going to be outside. But that person comes back. You've got somebody that's got a life sentence that's never going to be back out on the street. And yet we still have the mandate for rehabilitation.
What I do is put him to work. I think he can be productive. And in my experience of working with the inmates when I was, again, on the line, most of them prefer to be doing something meaningful while they're serving their sentences. And there isn't any reason why they can't be making a contribution, even if it's behind bars.
I had a meeting last fall with a group of inmates from our institutions, and it was kind of a broad-based group. And one of the things that I was concerned with and asked the questions, concerned with the convictions that Larry said, as they apply to that, was I asked the question of how would you treat some of these people that come in, because they were complaining about the insincerity of some of their own group inside the institutions, and they don't care about programs, they're not going to go through anything, they're going to sit there for 2 years or 3 years or whatever it is, they're going to do whatever is necessary to be in the least restrictive classification institution. But beyond that, there is no commitment to do anything. And I realize it's difficult with overcrowding to be able to deal with that. But the comment that came out of that was that they thought it would be far more effective to have a real jail, but not use that, and I mean a traditional jail in the worst sense, with the exception probably of personal violence, but that the inmates that go into the system, if they just spent 30 days in a real jail, the old style, very uncomfortable experience, and knew that if they didn't participate in work through programs, that was the potential. They'd get a lot greater response through all the programs and all the things that we're trying to do, whatever it is in the institution. That was coming from inmates that, you know, most of them have been there for several years, and they saw programs to strike like people didn't give a damn.
That's exactly.
Does the Clary settlement preclude us from ever being able to do this?
No, not in my opinion. And that's exactly what we attempted to do when we opened Eagle River back in 73. Our control mechanism at that point was that that institution was to be the shining star in rehabilitating programming. And inmates who didn't cooperate there were shipped to Juneau or to Fairbanks or some traditional jail. And it worked beautifully.
Constitution, as you know, it is unique in saying that rehabilitation is the overweening guide for incarceration. That may lead a court to say the presumptive sentence in the Alaska context is invalid because it does not, give enough deference to the rehabilitation goal on an individualized program basis for each offender.
I would find a finding like that to be very interesting. That would be encouraging, in my opinion. I think it would give us some courage.
Possibly. The trouble is that people criticize judges for the unusual case and don't realize that the judge's sentences were for presumptive sentencing, and 99% of the cases were pretty appropriate. There's always the oddball case, though, that gets a publicity. Let's go on if we can't do the prison treatment issue. We've already touched on it. One of the things that brought up by my colleague from Eagle River is the matter of prisoner endangerment. So where are we now? Where are we now, Commissioner? What have implemented to prevent delicacies, king crab and light, in the palate of inmates?
Well, very simply, we've stopped the availability of quite a bit of delicacies, those foodstuffs, from being ordered and served. We do have a problem on hand, though, in that we have to dispose of large quantities of those foodstuffs which are still on hand. And the Department of Administration consultant has advised us that we should perhaps trade or otherwise dispose of our food with perhaps pioneers' homes or other institutional facilities.
Josephine's restaurant?
You may be able to do that. What's happened is obviously things in corrections for years has had these kinds of foods available and served periodically. Normally, like crab meat is served, it has been served in strips on salad and so on. But in any case, with Senator Halper's investigation pointed out that the cost and the quantities and so on, we took immediate steps to stop it.
There were some conflicting versions of that, I think, as to the quantity of crab, the poundage run from a small number to a high number. Different dispatches.
Yes, I think we were talking about apples and oranges. The initial request had to do with the amount of crab meat on hand at Third Avenue. We responded to that, and then later it was reported that there were, I don't know, tons of this stuff available all over the state. So we were really talking about different things. In any case, what I'd like to point out is it's a dead issue. We are no longer ordering it or serving it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I had to ask on King Crab was on Highland Mountain. It wasn't on Third Avenue. Okay. The response dealt with Third Avenue. I never knew why and what happened. At the time, I assumed that was the only place there was any crab. Then my wife went to Department of Administration and went through about a foot of purchase orders and came up with a pretty extensive list. Well, that's where we came up with 22.8 tons of these things in combination: king crab, strip loin, prawns, scallops, primer, and palate. And the second sheet of that is an institutional breakdown. Basically, somewhere over $1 million in total orders, and an awful lot of expenditure in those kinds of foods. And I was kind of upset. I think that was a reasonable reaction. Now I know you got a problem about what to do with it. I don't. Well, one of the institutions right in the middle of Roger's efforts to deal with the issue decided they would feed 100 and some odd pounds of it. Apparently that's been the case for quite a while, because somebody in the correctional said that was a good way to maintain prisoner morale was great food in one of the newspaper articles. But I've got a letter here that let's see how long this thing is. This is a letter from an inmate that is still an inmate, so I would try to avoid reading where he is, but he works in the kitchen. I'd like to comment on the excessive consumption of crab and other seafood that recently has come to public attention. He was a kitchen supervisor in a facility, so I can give a pretty good account of how the correctional system wastes a vast amount of food that presumably, personally observed the purchase and consumption of over 100 pounds of shelled king crab in 1 month of this year. And we ordered 100 pounds in 2016 a pound, and the bill was over $2,000. Crab was consumed in 3 days, mostly by a small group of inmates that work as cooks in the kitchen and a number of correctional staff. I would say more than half of the 100 pounds was eaten by less than 12 to 15 inmates and staff. And this has been a standard practice of people that are allowed to work in the kitchen. The kitchen helps do a lot of work with very little compensation, say 50 cents an hour to make up for poor wages. The workers are allowed to eat most anything they want, such as steak, crab, shrimp, etc. I'm ashamed of the waste. While my wife and son go hungry and are too proud to get state assistance, I'd be most happy with a little ground moose burger and mashed potatoes. I don't eat king crab at home, but maybe twice a year at that. The criminal justice system is very messed up in this state. Consumption of and waste of food is a small problem in the whole perspective. And he wants to talk to me, you know. But that's out of inmate. And one thing I did learn in the last round of trying to figure out what's happening in corrections is the inmates are all in there for being cons of one sort or another, so I don't take everything they say with exact reading. But that was the kind of stuff that was there. What are you going to do now? You said you got a dietitian and so on and so on. What's going to happen?
Yes, we've got a dietitian under contract right now who's meeting with all of our stewards. We have ordered that a 6-week rotating menu be standardized statewide, and these so-called delicacies be taken off the menu, and in fact already have been. In spite of the objection, mine as well as yours, to the serving of very expensive food, our food costs average from $1.50 to $2 per inmate meal.
But that's computed on the basis of inmate days. And there aren't as many meals served as there are computed on that basis, according to the figures that I've checked.
These are actual costs based on the amount of food served daily to the amount of prisoners served daily.
Well, according to what I was told, there are a lot of people who are not in the institution through 3 meals a day, particularly in the lower security institutions. And the system basically counts an institution, and somebody that's there at any time during the day is a day and 3 meals. Anyone in transition or anyone else, that affects that count number.
What I'm getting at is that the cost of the food prepared at any given meal, say breakfast can be 83 cents a meal, lunch can be $1.50 a meal, dinner may range as high as $2 a meal, but an average to all meals, statewide, all institutions, comes out to $1.50 to $2 per meal. Based on the quantity of food served. So what I'm saying is,
why can staff eat for a dollar and families come in and eat for $1 still?
Because under the old departmental divisional policy, that was the old cost of food, and it was never upgraded. We are now looking at charging either $1.50 or, if it's justified, even $2 per staff or guest of the facility, whoever it may be, you or I or anyone else.
Do you or your dietitian take any means to address issues such as sugar content and other foods which may affect emotions or hyperactivity?
Yes, we've asked her to. I was interested the other day in attending a teleconference with Linus Pauling. I had a chance to ask a question or two late, but we've asked her to look at the orthomolecular concepts and see if we can't impose some of those concepts into the dietary nutritional value of our food services.
In your prisoner program summary at page Roman 2-23, speaking of Juno Winfrey, the department reports that a psychometrist provides psychological counseling to inmates requiring services. And then you say that in 1984, Mental Health Clinician 3 will be hired. My information was that a psychometrist measures a psychological condition but cannot treat it, that some of the inmates at Lemon Creek were paying for psychological services out of their own funds because they could not otherwise get them, and that in the department, people are moved from facility to facility, if I put it broadly, for the convenience of the institution without regard to whether they are in therapy with a psychologist.
given location. I'm kind of asking you three things at once, but...
First of all, I concur that a psychometrist is there to do testing, to do measurement, and not counseling services, so that I don't understand. I know nothing of inmates having to pay for the therapy, however, it's probably not a bad idea. And thirdly, the mental health clinician has just come on board and is now at work in a juvenile institution.
It's not a bad idea to pay for the
therapy. No, I think the public...
That's what the psychoanalysts say, it's part of the cure.
That's right. That's exactly right. There is an investment, not only emotional, but financial, which a person can invest in his own therapy, medical costs, dental costs, mental health costs.
But many of your prisoners have no capacity, financial capacity, at this time.
I don't even know that that's happening, but as I was suggesting, it might not be a bad idea so long as no one is denied treatment based on the
A question a little bit on the same line. Do the inmates basically get their college courses for free from any institutions?
They used to, but since I've taken over, I've insisted that we change that. In other words, inmates should contribute to the cost of their education, and education, particularly post-secondary education, be available to them in evening and weekend hours. And I do want them to make a contribution toward the costs.
So the concern that I have is that, you know, the individual on the outside, if he has to take courses that may be fairly expensive from the university system and have to pay for them, and the individual on the inside, if they're taking those same courses as an optional thing, should I hope pay the same thing? That's
university says. And we were in a great deal of trouble for that. That is, the inmates at council gave us a great deal of difficulty because he felt that we had no right to set higher standards for prisoners to take part in college courses than the university. So it's kind of an interesting quirk.
Whatever it's worth, we don't bring the carpets up. I'm not sure I agree with Senator Hopper on that. If there were an inmate who, you know, like we read, so many do become born again, and wants to go through a self-improvement program and go to college, without the opportunity to be outside working and having no source of income, I would hope that opportunity would be made available. I use the born again thing in a generic sense of a person who has a desire to self-improve, not in a narrow religious sense.
Well, I do understand, but I think it's also, one of the things I think we ought to consider is that that could get, theoretically, at least a four-year degree, come out with a bachelor's degree, and my guess is that what you would have is a better educated criminal. We've got to... I wish there were a way to have people who are concerned with public policy go in and work in these institutions, work with those populations, get to know these people, and find out, and I know what you'll find out, is that they're looking for the easy way, the majority of them, not all of them. But a lot of them don't have the skills, the simple knowledge, simple life skills, to know how to earn things, how to get things done, how to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning. The Juno Institution out here is still ringing bells. Tell people when to go to lunch, tell them when to get up, tell them when to go to bed, and so on. Those bells are going to go away. Those inmates can earn enough money to buy their own little alarm clock, and they can wake themselves up and get to where they're supposed to be when they're supposed to be there. That's how we institutionalize people, by giving them things, by not helping them to earn their way. And when they get out, they are institutionalized. They cannot survive on the streets. The longer they've served in that kind of environment, the less likely they're going to survive on the streets. So I do agree we shouldn't deny an education to someone because he has no resources. It's our obligation to provide him the mechanism to earn what he wants and to help him learn how to achieve what he wants to achieve. And we can do that. And we are doing it at some of our institutions, but not all of them.
Well, are you saying that it's undesirable to give people a bachelor's degree because they're better criminals or better educated?
More or less, yes, I am saying that. Because I've seen this happen over and over and over again. Not that they got college degrees, but they take college courses, they get out on the street, and they're a little smarter. Doesn't mean they're any less criminal.
Well, should we give Hanson writing lessons?
Well, I think I hear you saying something that I perceive to be inconsistent. On the one hand, these people lack they would to earn a living and have the discipline that they need to survive. On the other hand, if we provide college education and allow them to matriculate and succeed in that, we're not doing anything constructive, but we're making
social, so I'm confused.
Let me clarify that a little bit. What I'm saying is that what has to happen first is they have to learn life skills. They have to learn how to be responsible people. And really, it's very simple things to learn, but many of these people don't have those skills. Now, if somebody comes in and he has the capability intellectually to survive college courses, that's great, but he's got to do something to change his view of the world and his way of making his way in the world. And you can take courses in whatever, mathematics, engineering, psychology, English, whatever, it will not change that person's behavior except intellectually.
Well, I think what he's saying, and I agree with it, is, I think maybe it's what you're saying too, is that there's no way that they can afford an education, and we are not providing prison industries or other ways for them to be able to generate funding for education, then I think we should continue to help. If, however, there are programs available which they refuse to participate in, or they have the economic wherewithal to provide their own education, then we should not be providing them with the benefit that someone in the outside has to forego some other kind of optional thing they'd like to do in order to achieve. I think that's right.
We've covered the food stuff issue. We addressed the therapy and counseling issue somewhat. Did you have anything else in addition to the handout that you wanted to bring before us?
Well, I've got one more handout, which I think you already have, Mr. Chairman, but it's prison overcrowding and options that can be taken by various actors in public sector, including legislators, departments of corrections.
I had that to the governor myself. I sent this to you.
Yes, I had a copy, but you sent it to others, so that's why I didn't get it. But it does provide a list of possible options. Basically, you know, what it points out is you can change, you can bring about changes that affect the number of people who enter prisons, the length of time they spend in prisons, and alterations in capacity. And then it suggests that there are a variety of ways to bring about those changes in all categories. But legislators, prosecution, defense bar, judiciary, private agencies, probation, parole, governors, and departments of corrections all can take a variety of steps to try to alleviate the pains of overcrowding. There is no one simple solution, but there are a variety of excellent recommendations in these matrices that they've developed. you're talking to the people who are your constituents, but if you also go to the other institutions, I can tell you which institutions you're going to get negative feedback from. I can tell you which ones are going to be very positive, and you're going to be very surprised at some of the things that are happening in our institution right now. Good thing. I think it's going to continue. I also think that there's been a lot of support from the legislature, and I think that they, my impression is that they do understand how serious the problem is. I don't think anyone seriously doubts that, that we've got some major problems, which only the legislature can solve.
Well, are you going to call for another register on something and interview and go through a number of people and then appoint an active position? I don't mind the
first
concern.
Of all, I didn't do that.
I don't mind the concern for, in some cases, getting rid of some people. More of my concern is what happens on the way up and how those positions are then going. I don't see in the paper complaint, I don't see any partnership in corrections.
Well, let me give you a good problem on Facebook right now. I've got an acting superintendent in Fairbanks. And I'm looking all over this organization for somebody I can put in there permanently. The guy who's acting is not eligible. Now, he's holding that institution together, the previous superintendent retired, or is about to. The acting assistant superintendent is holding that institution together. We're looking at everybody we can possibly look at. That's not so bad. We're looking at everybody we can possibly look at in the organization to try to select and find somebody that we can select to put in there to manage that institution. And we've got problems.
But can't you do that through the register?
What I'm saying is that people on the register are probably not the best people that we should consider putting in.
See, I can agree with that on some of the people on the register. But if the system is so poor that you can't even with an expanded register reach qualified people, then rather than changing a specific instance, we should be looking at the entire register system or something. Complaints don't just come out of corrections. But as far as you've been able to terminate through one means or another, 20-plus people, and you've been able to do that through the register system, and probably one or two of them will file a grievance. But the point is that the system has worked to do that. And that's an area that I see as a real problem, and it is a management area. One of the things that has concerned me is that you're facing a lot of pressure and you're moving around very rapidly. You've been held in a political limbo position for a long time. And the question is kind of who's mining the storm? And I ask the question, I get an answer in February, and then I find that the response really didn't happen until April, and nothing happened. And although you didn't sign the letter, it came out over your printed signature block. And it just seems like the system isn't working from a management sense in responding to the food question, for example. The personnel system, you and I know that there's some reasons, and I agree with some, disagree with some of the reasons for the personnel shifts here and there. But acting positions are in an awful lot of places. And I don't have any idea of the individual's qualifications, but when somebody can go through a scenario that has been the case in the Wildwood case, or some of the other scenarios, there's got to be a better way.
The only response I have is that we'll follow state policies and procedures and state statutes. And as long as we do that, we may disagree on the action taken. But as long as we follow those policies and procedures, I can't find fault in that. Let me put it the other way. Once we violate policies and procedures or statutes, I don't see a problem. I've got to have any manager, we have to have the latitude to select the best people he or she can find to manage the organization. I know we agree on that.
But you don't mean that you would circumvent the personnel regulations?
That was true.
See, I guess I agree with you that the changes in the way positions have been done, not just your agency, but some of the others, may not be illegal. But when a register is open in an unpopular location, somebody gets on it and is transferred to a popular location, when a job is upgraded with somebody already in it, when these things are done, they're all legal and they're done by other agencies. But they're part of the reason that the morale and
system will work and allow me to reach the talented people that I know have got this organization, and I don't need PNs.
I would far rather work on making the system work than exempting something from the system.
We have someone else who wants to be heard. Commissioner, I want to thank you for coming. I think that, and for your patience with us, I think that this is an unusual situation because you have been on the job, in fact, since January 1983. And as I said before, that gives us a perspective that we would not normally have about a candidate for the cabinet, for a cabinet position. Your department is very important, very visible to the public, and it's very critical to the people of Alaska. And it is very sensitive politically, too. We've raised the views and concerns. It's very clear that some of us on the committee, which is our prerogative, don't agree with every decision you've made. But then again, you don't agree with everything we do either. Senator Halford and Senator Moss and I are all up for confirmation ourselves after 2 years in the job this November, and we may find some of the people who respond to us not liking all the decisions we made. But I find that you are, that you were selected by Governor Shenfield because of your professionalism and qualifications. And I hope that in the future, perhaps you have gained something from this exchange with us and other members of our legislature. And that is the spirit of what we've talked to you today.
I understand that.
Do we have other people who wish to be heard on the matter of confirmation of Roger and Dahl? Yes, sir. You may address the committee if you wish.
I'm Robert G. Holmstein, from Anchorage, ex-correctional officer of approximately 8 years, and I used to work for Mr. Mandel.
I'd like to advise you, we would look through your materials. I hope that you would address the question in terms of public policy, the broad public interest, rather than ask the committee to go into the merits of particular personnel action, if you're not really equipped to, okay?
Okay. As an ex-correctional officer and as a citizen of the state of Alaska, we all try to think the best of everyone and try to get things done. I think this will possibly help, if nothing else, other future correctional officers, if any of it is taken to heart. And I'll try to run through this just as fast as I can, trying to explain how hard it is for a person that is not that testified at a grand jury, how hard of a time he has to get promoted, how he's not in the clique. Well, I start out with, in 1975, they had a big investigation out at Eagle River, now known as Highland Mountain, with problems. Only thing on that little piece of paper right in the center, it says the letter down to the lower. The letter also asks that all employees in the jail system should be given the opportunity to testify before a grand jury and be given the umbrella of protection provided by subpoenaed testimony. And that is one of the big problems right there. Anytime you go in front of the grand jury, like I had, I never do it again, before I got out to Highland Mountain, everything I'd said in there was back to my superior. Okay, gentlemen, if I go too fast, just give me a holler. I know you won't have time to read all this. The second item is a...
This issue precedes the nomination of Mr. Endell,
correct? Excuse me, I'm sorry. At that time, Roger Endell was assistant superintendent. Stan Zabrak was the superintendent. And you're correct, that issue does before there was... because of the police department getting shot at, criminals escaping, they finally asked for a grand jury investigation. Okay, the second item, and you just have a few pages of it, gentlemen, and they may be a little bit mixed up as far as in not in numerical order. But you have a cover page which was signed by Judge Acapina, or Acapini at that time, who had more or less had all this information made up. If on the second page, real fast, I get down to about the last paragraph, says Eva River. Okay, it shows some of the people we had out there at the time, Lawrence Getty, Murder 2, Dewey Gray, Murder 1, Richard James, Murder 1, Arnold Rhodes, etc. Okay, next page. Come down, about the second the second line. Hardcore criminals are allowed to mingle freely with the inmates. So I come down to the center. Up in the center, they are allowed to place their lockers in a position, that's the inmates, so as to block the view of their room, resulting in a correctional officer having to physically enter the room to perform security checks. And this was at the time I was working there, and also at the time that Mr. Roger Indell was working there as assistant superintendent, who usually assistant superintendent runs more or less the jail, and now and then he'll ask the superintendent his policies or whatever, and he's more or less the man with the stick. We come down a little bit lower, it says that there's a great amount of drugs, searches of visitors weren't thorough. Come down to the bottom of the page, about six lines up, says, according to testimony, when a correctional officer writes an incident report on an inmate, the officer is subjected to a third degree by all inmates, and this happened to me all the time.
Now, did you testify before this grand?
Yes, sir. I testified, and that was my undoing as far as having to create a correction. Down at the about the third line up, last on this page, says, we also have read an incident report written by an inmate against a correctional officer. This was pertaining to me. I had been written up by an inmate. I ran off about 15 copies before I went to the grand jury, and they said, who's running the jail, et cetera, and I said, I don't know. I got written up by an inmate the night before, and they said, you got to be kidding. I handed the 15 copies out. Okay, the next page.
Well, is there anything per se inappropriate about having an inmate report dispute with an officer?
At that time, it was more or less we were on equal basis, and that's what I think led to a lot of the problems. You could write the inmates up, and they could write you up. And any time that the child writes up the father, if the father writes the child up, you're in big trouble. And that was one of the problems that we had out there.
Is it your position that in the proper system, an inmate should not be allowed to report
infractions
by an officer?
He should be able to report infractions. What is the system that they now have? It's known as a grievance. He fills out the grievance. It is investigated by another correctional officer. That's given to the assistant superintendent, and it goes all the way up, and they concur or they not concur. And so, therefore, you definitely need some way that officers and inmates have a grievance, because we both make mistakes on both sides of the fence. Okay, on the second to the last page, about the center, halfway over to the right, says, we wonder whose behavior patterns are being changed. We feel the administrators of Eagle River are directly, responsible, for the actions of their staff and should be held accountable to the public, just as I, the correctional officer, should be held accountable for, providing. Last page on this little scenario is at the top, board direction. Within this institution, testimony of correctional officers working with this institution indicates poor direction on the part of the administration. Administration also allows correctional officers, and I complained about this until I was almost reprimanded for it, allows correctional officers to use their own discretion in the following of institutional manual procedures. And I grieved it, and even when I was on temporary and made enemies with the administration because I was, in other words, I, as a newcomer, should have no input as to how the instructions were used. But I will say one thing, Mr. Stan Zavrak and Mr. Roger Dell at that time, they did have an institutional manual, which when I left was administratively terminated a few months ago, which they did not have then. But at that time, there was an institutional manual. And about the last thing folks, that sits on in reference to the findings. And that gives you a brief summary of the problems that we had at Eagle River.
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
What you're saying here then is this indicates, in your opinion then, that Mr. Indell was not properly doing his duties.
That's correct. Okay, on the next one, it says memorandum confidential. That's the one
I got in the right place. Do you think it's possible that someone might be better as a commissioner of the department as a whole than as an assistant superintendent in a particular institution?
Oh, I would say that's possible.
Excuse me, go ahead.
Sure. Almost anything is possible, definitely. This memorandum, gentlemen, is something I wasn't supposed to get a hold of. It's called...
I'd be better as governor than state
senator. I'd be better as assistant. We needed that. Anyway, a memorandum confidential. When they had the investigation, as the grand jury stated that, hey, you guys, you need more training, you need to select your officers better, kind of get your act together. So anyway, Mr. Stan Zavarak, he put out a little... a memo stating that from now on the correctional officers going to be hired would be screened. Well, this is some of the screening that was done in reference to me, and I wasn't even supposed to see it. And I was wondering why I was not going Mr. Indell, when I approached him, said Mr. Holmstein was going to have to terminate you. And he basically gave me the reason. But about in the center of the page where it says Roger Indell at the top, it says, as an example of one in response, he felt that offenders should be worthy of acceptance to this program. I did make that statement, and I still believe it, which the Division of Corrections, or at least at Eagle River, they have also come around to stating that. And exhibited an attitude, apparently, of double standard. Now, this is very important, double standard. One for offenders, i.e., insists that they follow the rules, and the second for staff. In a sense that abuses would be reported, apparently, only if the abuse caused problems for other staff or the administration. Well, since I'm here today, it cost me $352 because I'd asked the audience with Mr. Indell before I got terminated, and I was refused. So if I wasn't, I think I'm a pretty fair individual, and I've treated inmates, staff. If you're wrong, you're wrong. If you're right, you're right. So that is that was something that turned out it was not true. Come down just a short ways under that. His interest in corrections appears to be an expedient one so that his family financial situation can be better. Well, gentlemen, I think that everyone that works someplace, including all of us here, that is our primary thing, to take care of our wife, our family, and our kids. But anyway, so I was there for 8 years. I possibly got a little bit more time in grade, you might say, in correction than Mr. Indell. And a lot of the other people that I had to testify at grand juries, superintendents, which are not with us anymore, because there was corruption in the system at that time, and I don't believe it's not quite all gone. About the only other thing on that, we'll skip the center part. Mr. Lee Stratton, who's a psychologist out there, come down to where it says Dennis Benson, right in the middle, about in the middle, it says, also, I believe that he is referring to me, a very strict and rigid individual with high morals that he would expect others to live up to, and he would have difficulty in understanding or working with individuals to work up to his moral standards. Does that mean that we should get low moral officers? I don't know. Okay, so much for that. About half through. I have, when I saw out at Eagle River what was happening, and I did appear at the grand jury after only being there about 3 months, and I did have to ask to appear through Officer Pennington because for some reason or other, it's calling all the other officers, but they were not calling me. So I did appear at the grand jury, and later on, I had always asked my superiors, my shift supervisors, if I saw something that was in error, to take care of, I'm a firm believer in taking care of your own laundry. Anyway, this wasn't taken care of that way, and I went higher, because I'm a chain of a man of military, ex-military, and these are some of the telegrams in the last 3 years that I had sent to legislators, etc., and I think later was the downfall of my career. I was known as what I think Senator Rudy, 2 years ago, was trying to get a bill through called the Whistleblower's Bill, which I sent him a copy stating the following telegram. This was to Mr. Vic Fisher. Copy. Recently, I believe I sent you a telegram reference I'm a product of eight years of whistleblowing. However, your bill is exactly what public workers need to save government and taxpayers' money and themselves a career. Possibly would go to Juneau. Possibly would go to Juneau at own expense to testify in behalf of your much-needed bill. Please contact me in the AM or PM. My career is questionable when I will return to work soon after a major leg operation, which was at the 6th Avenue Jail where I was forced to go. And a year later, approximately last July, I was forced to go there again as a disabled veteran with a known leg, major leg condition, with two doctors' backups saying I wasn't supposed to be on my feet. I was taken out from a counselor's position at Highland Mountain under a reprimand stating that I was a security risk because I was asking for an outside investigation of the Division of Corrections and was having a hard time getting an outside.
Sir, on May 2nd, you sent that, you sent a telegram to me. Hope you receive my PO into all that clear. It's past resignation of Superintendent Zabarak for theft. Past Assistant Deputy Director Calkins for shoplifting and still working for corrections is only part of corruption. Please help me and other Alaskans with morals to expose and prevent future cover up in corrections. And you had sent on the same day, I think, to all legislators a public opinion message, correct?
That's correct.
In which you said, wish to testify at Endell's hearing, requested outside investigation of corrections in the past. Most recent, Endell agreed, then refused to talk. I was reprimanded and sent to 6th Avenue Jail, full duty, per Endell, knowing I'm disabled, been 51 years old, recent leg operation, correct?
That's correct.
Was administratively terminated. I have documentation of corruption. Do you have documentation of corruption?
Well, I believe, if I can finish with a little of this, you know, I've just got a few of the next thing we have is the telegram, which you all have there. That I, when Mr. Endell took over, I always kind of liked Roger and figured he was a victim, possibly of circumstances, out there at Eagle River where he was. But then again, as we know, if the captain of the ship says kill three of the crew and you go along with it, then you're kind of involved too. But anyway, on the next piece of paperwork we have here, I had... Anyway, I talked to Mr. Endell once or twice on the phone, and I said, we need to take care of this. That's been my outside investigation, because, you know, the gentleman just taken over the department, and I wanted to get it out of the way because, you know, this stuff here, I think it's, well, it's not right. So anyway, we get on here on the telegram, and it has more or less as a last resort again. It was twice you've broken your commitment on the 17th and then 28th of February to discuss with this officer the division's most recent in-house investigative cover-up done by your assistant directors, Ted Corey and Walt Jones. Related, but not limited to Assistant Superintendent Green's, that's the superintendent, assistant superintendent out of Highland Mountain right now, Green's past emotional breakdown to Highland Mountain. Green testified that he protected black inmate Ernest Taylor in his cell by using his body as a shield to prevent his fellow officers from harming Taylor, and that Green received two blows in the back from his officers, causing him to cry. I might say right now, this was an altercation. We had Mr. Green and about five of us officers were called, and we followed Mr. Green in to take care of a disturbance we had at Highland Mountain. The next sentence, I and fellow officers' integrity, professionalism, and careers have been damaged by Mr. Green's statement.
But were you one of the officers?
Yes, sir. And later on, I found out that on the sideline, and I have documentation of that Mr. Green had stated, not in the hat rack deal, the investigative report that I would not participate in, but he had stated that Mr. Hohenstein hit him in the back.
All right, when was this event supposedly taking
place? This was...
Your telegram was dated April 12th.
I can't remember when Mr. Green reassumed his duties as assistant superintendent. He was demoted once, and then he got him back. But I would say approximately about 2 years ago.
2 years ago?
Yes, sir.
Why were you exercised about this in 1984?
Okay, because the investigation had never been completed. It had an in-house investigation done by Ted Corey, and later I was privy to get the... the output of it, and then when I got the output of it, which everything that I had said on another telegram stating that Mr. Green should not be hired as assistant superintendent due to his threats that if he ever found out who had tattled on him, at the time that he had to get demoted, that that person was going to lose his job. Number two, that Mr. Green had outside interest, and number three, that anyone who brought corruption to the attention of corrections were demoted or harassed or blackballed. And this was still the same investigation.
I don't know the reason why you were terminated, but your position is you were terminated because you were a whistleblower, so to speak. Was that the reason?
Yes, the reason why I was terminated, which is the next page about through here, was that there was an account of money that was for the inmates that had been stashed away at a bank in Eagle River for 7 years. The inmates found out about it, and it was either a LEA grant or a federal grant for the inmates, something to do like with a halfway house where they can start up a janitorial system, which Roger Endell knows about because he and Stan Zyrax are some of the charter members. Okay, anyway, this money was found out by the inmates, and they said, well, that should be ours. Where is it? And they kept checking, because they aren't dummies, and they finally found out where it was, and there was two correctional officers, one with their name on the sign card, that could withdraw approximately $15,000. And one of the officers at one time had been out of the system for 3 years. But anyway, they were told to back off and don't interfere with that.
So I'm reading a letter from Mr. Corey to you saying that you've exhausted your leave without pay, and holding you in absence from duty status is causing hardship, and that if you resolve your medical disability, you're eligible for retire. The termination is administrative and does not dismiss someone. There's not a negative reflection of your work record.
Okay, the reason why I ended up down 6th Avenue was because the superintendent thought that I was a threat, or he had allegedly said the inmates had said that I had a personal vendetta against staff, which was still, I was asking for an outside investigation. So anyway, I received a reprimand after 8 years and was sentenced, or was sent down to 6th Avenue for a temporary tour of duty, knowing that I was not capable of performing that and that I would have to be terminated. So anyway, getting to there, I went down. Excuse me, go ahead.
You feel you were transferred into a position that they knew you couldn't handle physically?
Correctly, because it's documented, that, even in my records, that I wasn't supposed to be on my feet only so much by two different doctors.
There will be a... Sir, there will be a joint session of the legislature Tuesday to pass upon Governor Sheffield's nominees that require confirmation. I indicated earlier that we're not in a position to sit here as an arbitration panel of hearing officers to determine whether you were correctly dealt with in the personnel system or not, and we appreciate that.
Sure.
If you have evidence concerning... in addition to what you've already presented concerning Mr. Endell's qualifications, or the question of corruption, which you mentioned in your public opinion message to the legislators and in a phone call to my aide, Nancy Dietrich, in which I think you referred to an allegation of a theft of food funds by a secretary?
Right, this was in the past when Mr. Endell was assistant superintendent. This is some years ago.
All right. And anything else in the way of documentation that you'd like to present to us?
Well, sir, the only other thing I have there, then Ken Brown wondered why I was there, and I told him, he said, I can't use you. He told me to go ahead and take sick leave. I was on permanent sick leave until my sick leave ran out for 2 weeks, and then I was administratively terminated after my doctor said that if Mr. Holstein stays in corrections, he'd have to almost have a desk job for, you know, something that would keep me off my feet, which I had at Eagle River. And so anyway, I was terminated because they did not have a desk job down there, naturally, because that's not a desk job place. That's an intake. Or you're fighting drunks, etc.
What is your occupation, yes?
I'm about real estate. Yes, sir. So anyway, and about the last two things, and I just wanted to say to the board here, I've had last three evaluations, high acceptable. And I had one just a few days before I went down to Eagle River, to the 6th Avenue jail. And then 6 months after I was terminated, then I get one that was by the superintendent, wasn't even my rating official, all of a sudden taking me from one side to clear over to the other side, say I was unacceptable for rehire. The same man that signed that, which is Mr. Endell's Ted Corey, who signed my other one that said that this would not reflect upon your rehire, etc. So if you can justify that, for 2 days or something, and this is just an indication of how corrections, if they want to nail a guy, I guess they thought it was going to...